Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Welsh against Wisconsin. I'm meeting with the Attorney General just briefly. I'm having coffee, and I'm going to put him down and say, "God, six don't sound
good." Yeah, that's just the attorney. Tell him to send guys like that fellow from South Carolina. He was good.
Mr. Baldwin, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this is an exigent circumstances case. On that proposition, I think there is agreement between the State and the defendant. The issue in this case is whether an exigent circumstances doctrine will justify the arrest of the defendant in his home. The Wisconsin Supreme Court, applying Fourth Amendment standards, upheld the right of police, without a warrant and without establishing consent, to enter a home at night to arrest the householder for a traffic offense that was not committed in the officer's presence.
You said at night. About what time was it?
The officer reported he heard the call at 8:49 p.m. There was some dispute as to how long it took the officer to get to the house. I think it's generally agreed as about 9 o'clock. That was about a week before we would have gone on to daylight saving time, so it was dark. The Wisconsin Supreme Court justified the traffic arrest, applying its traffic arrest statute, and it held that exigent circumstances justified the arrest. It did so for three reasons. First, that the arrest was justified by a hot pursuit doctrine. Secondly, that the defendant, who, as I said, was arrested in his home, in his bedroom, constituted a possible threat to public safety. And third, that the arrest was necessary in order to secure evidence of possible intoxication. Now, on the facts, we do not know exactly what the arresting officer knew. The arresting officer relied on an eyewitness who saw a car driven erratically cross in front of oncoming traffic and stop or got stuck in an open field or cemetery.
When you said at the outset that this was truly an exigent circumstances case, did you mean that the exigent circumstance is the need of the officers to apprehend this gentleman while he might still be subject to a breathalyzer test or observation?
The officers justified, Mr. Chief Justice, the entry into the home as required by the need to obtain a blood alcohol test, Officer Daly said, within 2 hours of the event to be proved.
In other words, to preserve evidence.
This was to preserve, Officer Daly said yes, to preserve evidence of intoxication that he felt he had to enter the home under those circumstances. The officer had been called by a passing motorist and spoke to the eyewitness, and we don't know exactly what the eyewitness said, but there is a discrepancy between what the eyewitness testified on the stand, where he said he thought that the errant driver was either drunk or sick, and what he said, what the officer said he said. The officer said he received the opinion that the errant driver was definitely intoxicated. There was a difference. My point is that we would know what the arresting officer knew or thought if we had a warrant applied for during the course of that next hour or so. The officers did trace the automobile to the defendant's home, which was about half a mile away, went quickly to the home, knocked on the door, that is clear. What happened at the door is in dispute because the 16-year-old stepdaughter who answered the knock was not available to testify when this hearing occurred about 2 years later. The officer went upstairs to the bedroom where he encountered Edward Welch.
Did the circuit court make any finding as to whether there had been consent?
The circuit court explicitly said, we do not examine the question of consent. Its rationale was that the witnesses who were relevant to the question of consent were not then available. The circuit court held, Judge Frankel held, that the exigent circumstances doctrine, including the hot pursuit doctrine, justified this pursuit and entry into the home.
And the Supreme Court of Wisconsin likewise did not pass on the issue of consent.
The Supreme Court of Wisconsin likewise said that the exigent circumstances doctrine justified excusing the warrant and consent requirement. The Court of Appeals in Wisconsin, however, had reversed the trial court, but in turn, because there was no finding of consent, in turn, Wisconsin Supreme Court, by a vote of 4-2, found that consent was not necessary to be shown in this case.
Did the officer know the man?
The officer testified that he had remembered the name from an incident that happened, he said, a week or two before, actually probably was somewhat earlier than that, in which he said he had arrested Mr. Welch in an alcohol-related disturbance. That's all we have in the record. But it had nothing to do with traffic. It didn't say anything about traffic. It said it was an alcohol-related disturbance. That's what we have in the record.
He didn't know that he drove the car.
He obviously was highly suspicious, of course, sure. He was highly suspicious that the car had been driven by the owner, and the owner, of course, is the defendant in this case. But he did not know. No.
You mean that every car on the street is driven by the owner?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Well, I mean, what?
The officer was suspicious. This is no question about it. If, for example, Mr. Justice Marshall, if the officer had encountered my client on the doorsteps of the home, we do not deny that there would have been a right to stop, investigate, question, and if the officer found evidence of intoxication, to make an arrest. We don't deny that. That's a possibility. But we do contest the right of the officers.
I know, but the law must be different in your state. I thought that if the crime, a misdemeanor, was committed not in the presence of a police officer, you had to swear out a warrant. Is that the law in Wisconsin?
That is unquestionably the common law, Mr. Justice Marshall.
My question is, what is the law in Wisconsin?
I
and
regret.
A policeman on a story that somebody tells him has a right to go and lock up a man. Is that the law in Wisconsin?
The Wisconsin law, apparently from the Supreme Court of Wisconsin's opinion, does not require that there be an in-presence offense in order to arrest for a misdemeanor. The law was changed in 1971. The legislative history is obscure, but prior to 1971,
does the law say you could break the door down?
Absolutely not, sir. There's nothing in the law saying you can enter. It is our contention that the exigent circumstances doctrine should not apply for a misdemeanor or minor offense.
Mr. Baldwin, would you say that's true if the officer had personally observed your client behind the wheel and doing erratic driving and had observed all of the circumstances and had had to chase him to the house in an effort to apprehend him? Could the officer have followed him inside to make the arrest, in your view?
The answer I give to that, Justice O'Connor, is no. That it is, as long as it's a minor offense, if an offense had occurred, for example, failure to stay at the scene of an accident, for example, far more serious, could even be a felony in the state of Wisconsin, then the case for a hot pursuit and entry would be permissible. But it's our belief that the bright line, if you will, is at the door of the house for a minor offense.
Do you think it should make a difference from state to state as to how the state chooses to classify an offense? In one state, drunk driving might be made a felony and in another a misdemeanor. Does it make any real difference for purposes of the Fourth Amendment?
Yes, Justice O'Connor, I believe it does, for two reasons. I think they're illustrated by the law of Wisconsin. The first point is that reasonableness under Fourth Amendment standards requires a balancing of the actual governmental interest asserted to justify an invasion. What is the actual governmental interest? That is determined by the legislature. The legislature may view some offenses more seriously than other states, and balanced against the seriousness of the intrusion. Here's an intrusion into a highly protected place where expectations of privacy are greatest. The second reason may be, as in Wisconsin, that a state wishes to define reasonableness or define whether or not it has jurisdiction where an arrest has occurred under questionable circumstances.
Well, it makes it very difficult, doesn't it, for an officer in a jurisdiction where it would be a misdemeanor if there had been no prior conviction, but it would be a felony if there had, and the officer doesn't know that, and he doesn't know whether he has to stop at the door or not. That strikes me as kind of a difficult line to ask to
It is a difficult line, but it's a difficult line because the legislature of Wisconsin has drafted its driving while intoxicated statutes in that particular way.
But Mr. Baldwin,
sir,
I think the offense in Schmerber against California was also a misdemeanor. And yet the court there said that they could, the exigent circumstances existed for taking something from him by blood.
Justice Rehnquist, you're absolutely correct. The charge in Schmerber was for a misdemeanor. But as I read Schmerber, and I think it's in a footnote, the underlying act could have been charged as a felony at the time by the arresting officer.
So
the second
it
point
here?
Is, excuse
so
me.
Could it here?
So could it here?
So could it here?
Yeah, if he had known that he had had a prior arrest.
If he had known there had been a prior arrest, then I would have to rely on the exigent circumstances doctrine, and I couldn't make this assertion that the exigent circumstances doctrine should not apply to an arrest for a minor offense.
Mr. Long, could I ask you, what were you complaining about when you appealed? I mean, the reason your client had been hurt is that his driver's license had been revoked.
That is correct, sir.
And that's what you were really was complaining about.
That is the...
Well, isn't that so that the end result that you wanted to attain in the state courts was that the driver's license would be restored?
That is correct, sir.
Well, now isn't the revocation procedure a civil proceeding?
It is most certainly a civil proceeding.
Well, have we ever applied the exclusionary rule to a civil proceeding?
This court does not have to apply the exclusionary rule, Mr. Justice White.
Well, you want to say that the Fourth Amendment barred the use of this evidence.
The Fourth Amendment, Justice White.
You want to say that this refusal and taking him down to the station was a fruit of an illegal entry, and that's what your argument is. That's a Fourth Amendment argument to save your driver's license in a civil proceeding.
I don't know of any cases where, if I might correct, I think, Justice White, the problem is created by the law of Wisconsin. The breathalyzer test cannot be administered under the law of Wisconsin unless there has been a citation for the offense and an arrest.
I agree with you.
There must be an arrest.
Well, I agree with you, but nevertheless, it's a civil proceeding.
The state of Wisconsin viewed this as a criminal-type proceeding. The hearing judge who found that the
refusal... Well, I know, but that can't control the application of the Fourth Amendment. I don't know why we have to decide this Fourth Amendment case if after we decided that the evidence would be admissible anyway because it's a civil proceeding.
The state of Wisconsin applied Fourth Amendment standards, Mr. Justice White.
I know
under
they
Michigan
did.
Against Long, it seems to me...
I know they did. But the result is right.
Well,
there
is a link proceeding here, of course. I mean, it's perfectly clear there's a link proceeding. There is the charge of driving while intoxicated.
Well,
which,
I know,
of course,
but you aren't challenging.
No.
Were you convicted for it?
Oh, subsequently. It's not in the record, of
well,
course.
Well, yes, but you're not challenging the criminal
not
proceeding.
Not at this point. Not at this point.
And whatever evidence was seized or not hasn't... tainted or otherwise affected the criminal proceeding.
The Fourth Amendment, Mr. Justice White,
solely affecting to the
canceling your driver's license.
Well, this court has recognized that that's a serious interest. The Fourth Amendment protects people, their places, and effects from unreasonable searches and seizures. It isn't restricted simply to the protection of individuals in the criminal process.
I agree with you, but we're talking about the exclusionary rule.
Mr. Justice White, the exclusionary rule is not invoked here for two reasons. First, because Wisconsin law does not permit the breathalyzer or the blood alcohol test to come into evidence unless there has been an arrest.
Yes,
that's Wisconsin rule. It's not an exclusionary rule required by the Fourth. It's an exclusionary rule required by the law of Wisconsin.
But you're up here on the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled against you on every conceivable state ground you could have. So you must be here on a federal ground. And I, too, like Justice White, had thought you were making a claim under the exclusionary rule of the Fourth Amendment.
It seems to me, Justice Rehnquist, that the issue here is the reasonableness of an arrest, which is it's not a question of the necessarily the introduction of the evidence. It's the reasonableness of an arrest.
But why are you you're not interested in that in the abstract, are you? You're interested in suppressing the evidence that arose out of the arrest.
The suppression rule is simply a product of the law of Wisconsin. I am interested in the holding that this was a forbidden arrest under the Fourth Amendment.
But that's an abstract proposition under the ruling of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because you say that the Wisconsin Supreme Court may have misinterpreted the Fourth Amendment law of arrest, apparently, but nonetheless ruled against you. And if you are not entitled as a matter of Fourth Amendment law to have the exclusionary rule brought over to a civil proceeding, perhaps the Wisconsin Supreme Court opinion may have contained an abstractly wrong proposition of the federal Constitution, but the result was right.
Well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has construed an arrest as lawful under Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment standards, and it's what the Wisconsin Supreme Court has said about the arrest criteria is why we're here.
But you have to be here because of something it's done about the criteria, not because of what it's said about them.
Well, the consequence, of course, of the lawful arrest was the loss of driving privileges and, of course, incidentally, the introduction into evidence of the officer's testimony of what he saw in the bedroom in the criminal case, which, of course, is not before us. The exclusionary rule, which is a product remedial device of the Fourth Amendment, is not before this court. What is before this court is the lawfulness of an arrest of a defendant in his bedroom without consent and without a warrant for a traffic offense not committed in the officer's presence. Now, if the exigent circumstances doctrine applies, it is our belief that the facts do not justify its application here. There is no risk of escape. Edward Welch was where he had every right to be, in bed. He had every right to, the public interest is served perhaps by people who are sick or intoxicated going home to bed. Secondly, there were no firearms present nor any suggestion that any harm was going to occur to anyone. There was no cry for help. The case would be quite different if the Officer Daly at the threshold had heard the noise of breaking crockery and a cry for help.
Well, since you're speculating there, counsel,
yes.
Do you exclude the possibility that if not apprehended, he might go out and drive his car immediately?
Well, his car was half a mile away, of course.
Well, he might decide that after getting a couple of aspirins and some coffee to go out and get the car and bring it home where it'd be safe.
If he was sober, of course, that would be perfectly permissible.
Well,
the officers, he
might not be, but he might think he was. That happens.
There are several alternatives that would have been less stringent than simply entering the house without establishing consent, one of which, of course, is to keep your eye on the car, iron boots, or what have you. The second possibility is one of the officers could have gone for a warrant or called for a warrant. There is no explicit provision for a telephonic warrant in Wisconsin, but I read nothing in Wisconsin law that forbids the use of this innovative technique. The trial judge suggested there are three policemen in the home. Two could have watched the house, one could have called for a warrant or went to pursue a warrant. The only evidence that could be destroyed was that which was in the, excuse the expression, the lawful possession of the defendant. This is not contraband. If he was intoxicated, that evidence was not going to disappear instantly. It takes a period of time. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has allowed evidence of a blood alcohol test to be introduced 3.5 hours after an accident.
I'm not sure how you have distinguished Schmerber.
Oh, well, excuse me, Schmerber for 2 points. First, the underlying offense could have been far more serious in Schmerber. Secondly, Schmerber was arrested at the hospital, and the blood test was taken 2 hours after the event to be proven. It seems to me the exigencies in Schmerber were far more serious than the exigencies in the Welch case.
Why should it make any difference that the offense, in fact, might have been prosecuted as a higher level offense than it was? Isn't the critical thing of how the state, in fact, prosecuted it?
I think what the arresting officer knew, I submit, is important in establishing grounds for the arrest. But the penalty that the state assesses for a breach is relevant for 2 reasons. First, the penalty helps us establish how the legislature has viewed the seriousness of the underlying offense. The more serious the offense, the more severe the penalty. And secondly, the common law, which this court has said on a number of occasions is instructive in determining what is reasonable under Fourth Amendment standards. And at common law, as Justice Marshall has pointed out, arrests for misdemeanors require that they be in the presence of the officer and there be a brief peace. I'm not suggesting that is the absolute rule that this court should apply here.
Well, Schmerber is certainly against you on that point. It was a misdemeanor prosecution and
he was arrested where the police had a right to be, at the hospital, 2 hours after the event, under conditions where he might have received medical treatment or have been out of the custody of the police for a long period of time. There was a real exigency in Schmerber. In South Dakota against Neville, this court indicated...
Do you think you thought the exigencies made any difference in misdemeanor cases?
If the underlying
arrest... Real ones make a difference?
That's my fallback position, Justice White. Uh-huh. If it's a minor offense at the outset, I believe that the exigent circumstances doctrine does not apply to enter a home. Schmerber did not imply any right to enter the home. Schmerber was a blood test at the hospital 2 hours after the event to be proven under circumstances where there was no possibility of delay if the man was going to receive medical treatment and going to be incommunicado and unavailable. There would have been a greater intrusion if the police waited being treated in the hospital. This is a case of the entry into the home. As far as the police officer knew, it was a first offense. Even if the police had known it was a second offense, it still is punishable by the balance of authority established in the state as a minor offense. And if reasonableness, as this court has said it many times, in Terry, for example, in Camara, is a product of a balance of a consideration of the governmental interest asserted on the one hand and the severity of the invasion on the other, we submit that the governmental interest established by the Wisconsin legislature suggests that this is not the case for a significant dilution of the protection of one of these specific places and interests explicitly provided in the Fourth Amendment. Lower courts have given us a number of different tests on exigent circumstances. I urge this court to look carefully at the California formulation, which emphasizes urgency, which emphasizes the need for speed, and emphasizes the need to protect immediately life and limb. This, we submit, is not the kind of situation that fits the Californian definition of people against Ramey. The District of Columbia definition has been criticized by the academics as perhaps complicated, but the District of Columbia formulation, which relies on 7 factors, I submit has some value because it is a response to the human problem. How do we define this broad generalization? Let's look at the specific facts. Let's try to categorize. The 7-factor formula of Dorman, which we cite on page 43 of our brief, it has utility, and while It's not as a guide to the policeman. What is a guide to the policeman is you don't enter a house at night for a minor offense without consent or without a warrant, particularly if you haven't seen the offender yourself. I would like to reserve a few moments for rebuttal.
Mr. Kleinmeier.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. As indicated by the petitioner, the state in this case relies on the exigent circumstances doctrine to establish the reasonableness of the warrantless entry. And under that doctrine, the warrantless entry to arrest or to search may be made if the police possess probable cause and exigent circumstances. In this case, the exigent circumstance relied upon by the state is the need to, the primary exigent circumstance, the need to obtain evidence before it's lost. The police were after Mr. Welsh to arrest him for drunk driving. And as the court has indicated in Schwerber, in a case of drunk driving or an intoxication offense, the evidence will dissipate gradually in the blood and over a period of time will disappear. Therefore, there was a need to immediately enter the home in order to obtain the evidence as soon as possible. A delay that may have been occasioned by obtaining a warrant during a delay, even if not all evidence of intoxication would have been lost, there would have been a period of some dissipation of the alcohol. And it's just unknown how much would have been lost. It's also important because there's no way until the police have contacted the suspect for them to know when he stopped drinking. So he may have already stopped several hours before, still be intoxicated, by the time they get a warrant, no longer be intoxicated.
General Kleinmeier, may I ask you a question? I'm just wondering if the case might possibly be moved. Your adversary indicated the man has actually been convicted of the misdemeanor offense. I gather that's a matter of public record if it's the fact.
That's what I understand.
If that were true, was his license automatically revoked as a result of that conviction?
I don't know what happened, what the judgment was. The case, as I understand it, his appeal in that case is pending in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, waiting the outcome of this, because he's also challenging the arrest in that case.
I
assume that any penalty imposed in that case would have been stayed pending his appeal, but that I don't know.
I take it then he was convicted in the criminal case without the state using the evidence of the refusal to take the test.
I don't know what evidence was used.
Because I wondered in reading this record really how badly you needed this evidence. This man is pretty strong evidence that he was intoxicated. And doesn't your exigency depend, I take it, on the fact that you really needed the evidence in order to prove your case?
Well, I think they would like this evidence of a breathalyzer or a blood test would have been much better, much stronger case, obviously, than the evidence from Mr. Jablonik, who observed him only for a couple minutes.
Well, but that's not the only evidence he had. He saw him drive, too.
Yes.
He smelled his breath.
But well, it's a matter of... Go ahead.
In the first argument pointed out, there's some discrepancy as to what Mr. Jablonik saw. He said one thing. The police officer said that if he called something else...
he didn't testify,
trial court,
did he?
At this hearing, well...
Presumably, he was available as a witness at the main trial.
Yes, he did testify. What happened was, in the drunk driving case itself, there was a suppression hearing challenging the arrest. Mr. Jablonik testified, Officer Daly testified, Mrs. Welsh testified. Then, in the separate proceeding challenging the reasonableness of the refusal, there was a question raised as to the arrest.
Well, that's this proceeding.
That's this proceeding case. Now. All the parties in the court relied on the transcript and the findings from the drunk driving case to rule on the legality of the arrest for purposes of the reasonableness hearing.
And do I correctly understand that if the arrest was unlawful, whether for state reasons or federal reasons, that as a matter of state law, the refusal to take the test could not have been put into evidence, if the arrest was unlawful?
In this proceeding, where it is to revoke his license, the police officer is not entitled to order him or request the breathalyzer unless he has first legally arrested him. So I think as a matter of state law, the Wisconsin courts have taken the position that the legality of the arrest depends not only on satisfying Wisconsin arrest statutes, but on satisfying Fourth Amendment requirements.
So you agree that we must, that the Wisconsin Supreme Court was required to decide the federal constitutional question in order to dispose of the case?
Yeah, I'd like to be able to take the other position because it wouldn't.
But it's not. It wouldn't.
I don't believe so. I think that the other one is that they incorporated the Fourth Amendment as one of their criteria in determining the legality of the arrest. On the exigent circumstance, another reason that...
Before you go into the exigent circumstances, is the inception of the concept of the exigent circumstances affected by the observations of the seriousness of his driving condition? For example, the witness, Jablonik, I think his name was, said he had undertaken to interfere with this fellow's driving, apparently, because he was afraid he was going to kill somebody.
Yes.
Now, what impact does that have on the whole picture of exigent circumstances?
Well, I think that would indicate that at least Mr. Jablonik was concerned that this person was quite intoxicated, and that if he had returned to his car or stayed in his car and tried to drive it some more and gone back on the highway, that in his condition there may have been an accident, especially since he had just, Mr. Jablonik said he had seen the petitioner drive, go down the wrong lane, the left lane, and coming head on towards another car, and he at that point was able to veer off to the left before an accident. But I'm sure he's afraid that if he continued to drive that he may not be so lucky the next time. Which would indicate that they wanted to, at least Mr. Jablonik was concerned that something be done about his condition as soon as possible. At this point, I cannot recall if that Mr. Jablonik expressed that same fear of the police officer at the time, however.
Well, the statement in your record is, because I realized they would probably kill somebody, and I immediately did this and so.
That was Mr. Jablonik's testimony, yes. I believe that's why he stopped his car to block the path of Mr. Wells if he had tried to get his car out of this lot. But primarily...
Was that evidence available for a license cancellation proceeding?
Well, he can... Mr. Wells's... Yes, in that his license could be suspended either through the reasonableness hearing for refusing the breathalyzer or as a result of his conviction for drunk driving.
Just so I'm clear on it, I take it here the license was suspended because of the refusal of Mr. Welch to take the breathalyzer or the blood alcohol test.
In this proceeding here, yes.
And he asserted that his refusal was reasonable because the arrest was unlawful.
Yes, because...
And under Wisconsin law, if the arrest is unlawful, is that treated as a reason for refusing to take the test?
Well, the trial judge accepted that, and the officer is not entitled to even request him to take the breathalyzer until he has arrested him, a valid arrest. So that's a requirement for even asking for the breathalyzer.
When the officer was at the door, does the record show that he was aware of Jablonik's statement in detail that he was afraid the driver was going to kill somebody? Or was he just responding to the telephone warning that the lady had given?
No, Mr. Jablonik had stopped his car to block Mr. Wells from moving his. Another motorist stopped, and Mr. Jablonik asked that motorist to call the police. Presumably, that person called the police because the police did receive a call. The policeman responded to the call and went to talk first to Mr. Jablonik, who then related some information to the police officer. The police officer at that point also checked the license plate in the car, so I obtained some identification of the driver, and then at that point went to the address listed to that person. So before he had gotten to the house, he had talked to Mr. Jablonik. This court, in other cases, in another drunk driving case, in a context of a different issue, has all again recognized the need for obtaining evidence of intoxication as soon as possible. In the Mackey versus Montrum case, the court said that in order for the state to protect the people from drunk drivers, the state has to have the authority to obtain the breathalyzer test for evidence of intoxication at the earliest possible moment. And again, that's simply what this officer said he was trying to do. That's why he went to the house and did not try to get a warrant. I think that the exigent circumstances prong of this to get into the house has been satisfied by the need to obtain this evidence. The other prong is probable cause, which in this case the petitioner says is not a problem. So just under those two tests, it would appear that the police were justified in going in the house. However, as I understand the petitioner's objection now, is that we can't apply this exigent circumstances test because drunk driving was not a felony. It was not a serious enough offense. A first response to that is just on this major-minor distinction is that drunk driving is a very serious offense. This court has, in its own cases, indicated the number of people that are killed on the highway each year due to drunk drivers. And just looking at it that way, I think drunk driving is a serious offense, justifying action by the police.
Is the first offense a crime?
In Wisconsin, no. I think that might be the only state where it's not.
Well, that it suggests that your legislature may have created this problem?
Well, yes, they equated this question. I think there's also, they've pointed out that they are still concerned about it enough that they authorized an arrest without a warrant. I think under the petitioner's theory, he draws a big distinction between a felony and a misdemeanor. And apparently in this case, had the Wisconsin legislature merely classified drunk driving as a felony, we would not be here. In other words, he's leaving it up to a legislative decision. And if the state can act to justify this arrest simply by classifying this as a felony, I think the state can also express its interest in this offense through its arrest laws. Because if we're only talking about reclassifying as a felony to justify the arrest, I think the state can classify it as a misdemeanor or forfeiture, and in another chapter of the statutes, authorize an arrest for misdemeanor or forfeiture on the basis of probable cause, which Wisconsin has done. It has passed statutes changing the arrest law from the common law. Under the statute in the felony code, the criminal code, is that police officers may arrest for any crime if they have reasonable grounds to believe that the crime has been or is being committed.
The only trouble with your argument is that your court doesn't agree with you.
No, I don't understand how they don't agree.
Well, I mean, your court didn't agree with what you just said. In this case.
Well, in this case, they said that the officers had probable cause to believe that the offense had been committed, and on the basis of that probable cause, they were authorized to make the arrest.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the statute in the criminal code dealing with misdemeanors and felonies classifying together, there's also the statute in the motor vehicle code.
I couldn't get it out of that opinion at all. I got it out of the dissent.
Well, the issue presented to the Wisconsin Supreme Court was whether there were exigent circumstances and whether there was probable cause. And they found probable cause and exigent circumstances, and with those two, there could be the arrest in the context of this case. Now, in the criminal code, misdemeanors and felonies are treated together because they both fall in the definition of a crime. So the legislature has indicated that its interest is that the police have the same arrest authorities for a misdemeanor or for a felony. In the motor vehicle code, the statute provides that a law enforcement officer may make an arrest for a traffic regulation, violation of a traffic regulation, if he has reasonable grounds to believe that the violation has occurred or is being committed. It's parallel language. So I think the legislature has indicated that it wants the arrest authorities for its officers to be the same, whether the case involves a forfeiture, a misdemeanor, or a felony. It's expressed its concern that way as opposed to classifying this as a felony. I think just because it gives a drunk driver a break by not calling it a felony doesn't necessarily mean that it's not interested enough that it wants to obtain convictions for the offense.
It isn't just giving him a break by not calling it a felony. It also doesn't have the penalties associated with it that it would if it were a felony. He can't go to jail for as long and so forth.
That's correct. But he's still getting the break by not having it classified that way. There's still a decision. But
isn't it true that the penalty that the state legislature seeks to impose is one of the ways we determine how important the state interest in the matter is?
That's correct. It's one of the ways. And I think another way is looking at how
the procedure for arrest.
For enforcement of the laws. And here I think they've indicated through their arrest law, which they've made the same for traffic regulations as for crimes, that they also want those regulations enforced just as strictly as crimes, whether a crime be a misdemeanor or a felony.
There are other categories of misdemeanors that are not so treated in Wisconsin for arrest purposes.
No, that all crimes in Wisconsin, whether it be misdemeanors or arrest or felonies, are subject to arrest on probable cause. I mean, there is no misdemeanor that has to be committed in the officer's presence to be subject to arrest. Just all misdemeanors.
In your mind, is there a right of an officer to follow any misdemeanor offender into his home to make an arrest, regardless of the nature of the misdemeanor?
Well, he would have to have exigent circumstances to go with the probable cause. I think he cannot just, simply because he has probable cause to believe a misdemeanor has occurred.
Well,
just
he
as
has
with a
probable
felony.
Cause to believe someone has committed a misdemeanor offense and that the person is getting away and going into his home to avoid arrest. Is that enough?
Well, I think he has to, under the normal exigent circumstances, it would require, well, more than just think he's going into his house to avoid the arrest at that point. If he
doesn't our Santana case answer that in the affirmative?
Yes, that's where if the officer saw the offense being committed and immediately followed on the hot pursuit theory, have a third party reports to the officer that a misdemeanor occurred 2 days before. Just because the person's in the house, the officer, I don't think, can walk in. If he believed that the person was going to get an airplane in the next 15 minutes and fly to Alaska or to somewhere else, then he has the other exigent circumstance of fearing the suspect is going to flee.
If it were shooting birds out of season and he thought they were going to be eaten in the next hour and a half, they could go in and...
I think under that qualification is he has to have it's a reasonable probability that's going to occur. He can't just think of the possibility. It's a reasonable probability.
General, in Wisconsin, is a police officer entitled to shoot a misdemeanor who's trying to run?
I just don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if there's any statutory question.
You said it was all the same.
Well, as far as arrest authorities, the other...
Oh,
actions
this is limited to arrests.
To arrest in the context of unprobable cause. I think this court has already, as far as what type of offenses an officer may enter a home to make an arrest with exigent circumstances, already indicated that the entry can be made in the case of something less than a felony. I think in this case it also has to be remembered or being recognized, this case is not simply a question of arrest. The case involves, obviously, a question of search. They needed to obtain this evidence. They weren't going to arrest the evidence. They searched coupled with arrest. In the Camara case, which we've heard a lot about this afternoon, heard many times, it involved a misdemeanor. The violation of the building code in that case was a misdemeanor. The court held that the building inspector could enter the home, or normally needed a warrant to enter the home to check for the building code violation. However, of course, the entry could be made without a warrant if there was probable cause and an emergency existed. And I think the emergency language in that case is the same, they're referring to the same things, exigent circumstances. Some of the cases cited in Camara for the emergency, and have also been cited in other cases under the heading of exigent circumstances. I think the Camara case indicates that it's under the Fourth Amendment, the police can enter a residence to search for evidence of a misdemeanor if they possess probable cause and exigent circumstances. It's the same type of cases here. It's something less than a
felony. What if you had a building code violation and the police had the same degree of reliable evidence they had here, but they were afraid the man was about to fix it? Could they break into the house to arrest him before he fixed it? Because that would avoid the evidence.
Again, under the cases on exigent circumstances, it's more than just speculation or fear by the police. They're going to have, I think, a reasonable belief.
Well, say they had fairly reliable evidence that was about to happen, as they did here.
Well, I think
a building... They want to be sure to get a conviction.
Yeah, building code violations, I think, are somewhat different in that usually you enforce the building code violation to cure the violation. If the threat of arrest is going to cause the person to cure his violation, maybe it's already served its purpose.
Well, of course, one might argue that keeping this man in bed might have been the best way to avoid the danger you're concerned.
However, when the police entered, they did not know he was in bed.
Well, anyway, I gather your position is that the exigent circumstance is satisfied sufficiently by the possibility of the disappearance of the alcohol.
That's correct.
And that's, you don't think you have to rely on anything more than that, do you?
Basically, no. I think that exigent circumstances doctrine applies however the legislature happened to classify the offense in this case. And I think that pretty well sums up the case also. Thank you.
You have anything further, Mr. Baldwin?
I'd like to answer Justice Stevens' question insofar as I have been informed by the principal counsel for Mr. Welch. He was convicted at a jury trial in early 1982, at which his refusal to take the blood test was in evidence, which is permitted now under South Dakota v. Neville. Secondly, Officer Daly testified as to what he saw in the bedroom, and Mr. Jablonek testified. Mr. Jablonek, incidentally, did not smell the errant driver's breath. For one reason or another, he didn't smell it. But the jury did convict. One of the jurymen was the wife of one of my law students, and this is one of the sources of my information. Secondly, this court has considered the problem of carnage in the highways in a number of instances. But I want to call your attention, remind you of Craig against Boren, an interesting case because of the way Justice Brennan dealt with the problem of statistics, in which Oklahoma had shown that there was a very high probability, a higher probability of drunken driving offenses committed by young men than by young women, but that despite these statistical features, which were really quite overwhelming, it did not justify a deprivation of a 14th Amendment claim to equal protection. Similarly, this court in South Dakota against Neville, in a footnote, indicated that perhaps the blood alcohol test would not have been appropriately taken or could not have been appropriately mentioned in the case if it had been forced upon the defendant. My point is that this court has recognized that in the battle against drunk drivers, there still are 14th Amendment protections. Similarly, in Mincy against Arizona, this court has declined to find a murder scene exception. My final slogan, and I think this is a helpful one, is that exigency is not the same as expediency. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Tuesday next at 10 o'clock.